Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, our publications, podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter, make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. Well, I'm grateful to be joined today by Dr. Nick Ellis, founder and CEO of Christian Halls International. He has also founded or led various organizations in North America, Brazil, Africa, and Europe. And he was educated at the University of Oxford, receiving a Doctor of Philosophy and Master's in Theology and Religion, as well as at Trinity Western University with a Master's of New Testament, and at Union University with a Bachelor's in Biblical Languages. I'm really excited for our audience to hear about this growing network of educators, which is Christian Halls International, which is what we're talking about, because I think it's one of the most promising examples of entrepreneurship in higher education in a long time. And I also think it's a great opportunity for many current and aspiring educators, and especially in this rather tumultuous time within higher ed. We're also going to talk about a sense of place, which is a key piece of what makes Christian Halls different. So welcome to the show, Nick.
Well, it's great to be here, Josh. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, now let's start simple. Give us an introduction to what Christian Halls is and how it works.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's a good question because it's a complex problem that we're trying to solve. You know, we all know the challenges that are out there in the higher educational industry, both in terms of cost, the instability of the industry, the ideological challenges that we all face. But I think more than anything else, a growing sense within our families and our communities that the higher educational industrial complex does not necessarily know how to serve local communities and local places. And it was that sense of a need for change that led us to create Christian Halls. And so let me give you the bare bones description of what we're doing and how we're doing it. First and foremost, Christian Halls is a returning of post-secondary education to local communities of faith to serve and bless their places. And that includes an academic component that we'll talk about. It also includes a very rich sense of how does the formation of our people, of our next generation, not just as individuals, but as members of a community, how do we love our place well? And a line from Wendell Berry comes to mind, that, you know, how do we show that we are worthy of our place and not just try to make our place worthy of us?
That's a good
one. And so to do that, what we had done, and I came out of the Brazilian context, grew up there as a missionary in Brazil.
Really? Okay.
And we had been heavily involved in K through 12 education. We kind of kickstarted the homeschool movement in Brazil, decriminalized that at the national level. And then we began to work in the classical education space, mainly through licensing. And so we kind of cut our teeth on licensing curriculum and books and those kind of things. And if it walked and talked, you know, homeschool and classical education here in the States, we licensed it. Classical Conversations, Veritas Press, Apologia Press, working with Classical Academic Press, you know, various other organizations. We licensed that and translated everything into Portuguese, started a publishing house called Classical Press Brazil. And that became supply chain for our planting movements. And our planting efforts were to go out and help local families, churches, community members start educational centers that could really take on the shape of what they need. It could be a 2-day academy, it could be a 5-day classical school, maybe it's a homeschool co-op. And we planted about 500 of those across Brazil. And so that really kind of reshaped the almost the social imagination of what is possible from a self-governing place-based educational model in a context which is very much a kind of a leftist Marxist kind of incubator in the education space. This was a new idea. You know, how do parents, families, and the community of faith self-govern the formation of their children? That was the premise for the Brazilian project. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was off in Oxford. I was doing my doctorate there, and ran into the Oxbridge tutorial model, this small tutor-led small group cohorts of students that would come together and, you know, in their colleges around Oxford and Cambridge, prepare themselves for the university exams. And very quickly saw that there might be an opportunity to bring that kind of model back to our places across our mission activity, Brazil, East Africa, some of these other places. And so went to my various different university presidents that were friends of mine, and with some fear and trepidation said, you know, if you guys can be the academic provider, the quote unquote manufacturer, if you can be the accreditor and the systems group, setting best practices and, you know, assessments and those kind of things, very much like the University of Oxford does to the Oxford colleges, I would like to go out and build, at the time I thought dozens of what we call private halls that are really this gathering of the local tutors, the holders of the Christian intellectual tradition within these communities. Many of them who do not want to go and work at a university, or they have worked at a university and have retired, or in the common arts, tradesmen and businessmen and, right, and elders and leaders who kind of hold the tradition. And our educational systems don't really have a place for that kind of eldership, that multi-generational eldership. Mm-hmm. And so basically pitched a licensing deal to these universities that allowed us to acquire the rights to their online degree programs to go and install in these communities, but with the caveat that the client was the place. Mm-hmm. The client was the local hall, and the universities had to become the vendors, because we did not trust these institutions to know how to serve these communities. Yeah. They're just tooled for it. And very surprisingly, we got about a dozen universities, now about 350 degree programs, something like 15,000 classes.
Jeez.
All in academic supply chain. That's probably the best way I can describe it. It's academic publishing supply chain.
Wow.
And it worked. I think that was probably the biggest surprise. We had a bit of a leg up, because we already had, you know, these hundreds of communities across the Latin America context where we had tutors and students and communities that were set up. And I confess, Josh, that I did not think this was going to be a North American mission.
Hmm.
And COVID hit in 2020, and we started to get phone calls from all of these families and communities and churches in the U.S. saying, you know, could you bring this back to the States? And I was like, why? You know, you have more Christian universities in, you know, North America than you have in any other country in the world combined. Like, where's the need? And, you know, you have to remember that I've spent most of my life internationally between South America and Europe.
Right.
And they said, you just don't really understand what's happening. You know, mm-hmm. the collapse of the higher education industry, the skyrocketing costs, the ideological warfare. But again, more than anything else, they take away our best and our brightest. They siphon off our talent and our treasure, and they don't know how to send it back, these institutions. And so we came back to the States and just started to engage with some churches, some homeschool co-ops, some private classical schools, saying, what would it look like for us to build in these places to serve these communities? And I think that that was the most important thing that we did is instead of starting with the product and saying, hey, why don't we sell you some courses, that we start with the place and say, what are the needs of this particular place? And then say, well, what is the human capital? Who are the people that are in this place that God has gifted this place that can contribute to the intellectual, spiritual, physical formation of its members? And only then do we try to triangulate in and bring, well, what are the kinds of programs, products, degree programs, trade certificates, all those kinds of things in service of place and people. And that, I think, subsidiarity based approach, kind of using, kind of Catholic theological terms on this, I think that set things in order in a way that started to cascade a whole series of things. So we show up at this small town in South Texas, and at town hall, 1,000 homeschool moms show up, all Latino, Spanish speaking, about 50% Catholic, maybe 50% Pentecostal, a couple Baptists, and they just simply said, we are tired of sending our kids away to secular state universities that do not like our religion. They despise our values, and they strip away our best and our brightest from the valley. And what was amazing about this community, this place, is they had the memory, a cultural memory of the old Spanish missions, up and down the valley. And they said, we will rebuild that model as a subsidiarity-based, local, self-governing, tutor-based, multi-generational approach. Because what's amazing about that culture, they have not broken the kind of the multi-generational context. They still have deep respect for elders. Grandpa and grandma are still in the home. They own family businesses. They've got that kind of multi-generational framework. So what I was pitching to them, which was, rejuvenate, revitalize all of this wealth of wisdom and knowledge in your communities, and mentor your students, mentor your generation, whether it's in the trades or in political science or public administration or business or whatever, you should hold the governance of the formation of your own people. And so then you compare that with, all these other places that we're in. Every one of these places have their own needs. They have their own people. They have their own realities. And so by prioritizing place as, the aligning the affections of the heart with the needs of that place and seeking to serve that place across the generations gives us a better order to how we can start to align our work and our teaching. And so in the end, we've got several hundred of these communities internationally, but in the last since 2021, when we really launched, we've got over 170 of these communities now that have launched. And we think that this can go county by county. And the challenge here, of course, is how do you structure this kind of work so that it does not become colonialized, centralized, franchised, because it will eventually, if you centralize it, it will rot and it will corrupt. How do you create a subsidiarity-based model, but also create the kind of training, quality control, that allows both diversity of communities, but also doesn't just kind of spin off the rails? And so that's kind of where we're in now. But so the nuts and bolts of kind of how it works is that when we come into a local place and we meet with those community elders, pastors, business leaders, civic leaders, and we ask the question, using education, how can we contribute to the flourishing of this place? And I think it's important to recognize that we're using education, but we're not treating education as the end. Education is in service of a larger, flourishing that can take place. This educational, moment when you choose, like, where do you go to college, can either be a very positive thing for the community or a very negative thing for the place. Most people have been taught that if I don't leave my place, I'm a loser. And we have to tell a different myth, which is if you stay, if you build businesses, engage in civic duty, die with your grandchildren at your feet. That not winning, not losing. Like, yeah, there, but there's a myth that's in our head, especially a very North American myth, actually. A very American myth that says, I as a person, as an individual, I have to go and make my own way somewhere else. Otherwise I'm a loser. And so that we can use education and models of education to undermine that narrative. And so when we come in, we identify, well, what are the kinds of programs that this community needs? And typically what ends up happening is they say to me, well, if we could just do like a Christian conservative junior college, just those first 2 years of university, so our 18-year-olds going off don't run into the wood chipper of, leftist secular thought at the university. Just give us that. Like, we got all those classes and cool, you've got tutors that can handle humanities, math, science, and, social studies. Three tutors in your community, who are your most trusted, most faithful, godly English teachers that you know? And so we can very easily start that kind of, Christian conservative junior college, community college program. And from there, it becomes a question of specialization. In this particular community, where's the human capital that is willing to step up and say, I'm going to form and shape these people, which is nothing more than the old collegium, the old gathering of fellows to say, we as friends are going to come together, participate in the tradition, and we're inviting you to come join us, right? Our problem is that the professionalization of the educational industry in North America stiff arms those kinds of people because we don't. We want to create a professional class of professor. And so we don't have the old kind of Anglo-Saxon, almost abbot model of every community, every town, every county has a monastery or an abbotry. Come and gather together. And so you could say that I am just as much interested in the revitalization of eldership as I am in creating transactional four-year experiences for students.
I wanted to let me stop at that point because I think yes, there's so many practical questions I have in mind. I'm sure that in our audience's mind as well. Because I immediately recognize, some of the so many of the problems that you're saying. I mean, this placelessness. I mean, there's been research on the kind of the brain drain, especially of rural America, and in small towns, how these people leave these communities, they don't come back, they go off to college, right? And I grew up in the 90s where I ex certainly experienced and was essentially taught, not necessarily by my family, but others, that like if you don't get out of this Southeast Michigan town where I lived at the time, like you have failed. And so that is a toxic myth. Where did that originate? We don't have to go into that history. But I also was thinking a couple things here was how in the universities I've worked for, several of them, in many instances, my colleagues, other faculty, they did not live in the town where they were teaching, which is just bizarre to me when I think about that. There's been some movement away from that. There's actually in some cases, to be a faculty member, you have to live within this many miles of the campus now. That seems to be happening at both state and private schools, which is interesting, but because they're starting to recognize it. But also, if you just look at the mission statements or vision statements of a various university, seldom do they look toward the neighbors in the town that they live. Now, there's exceptions to this, but most of the time it's we're you know we are forming students who will go and change the world in some way, shape, or form, right? It's the global, it's that, we're going to put the world on your shoulders, students, before you leave here. When the truth is, the best we can do, and this is not a bad thing, is to just do a good job in our neighborhood. Like, hey, change your zip code. And make your zip code a better place. Might be even that's quite ambitious. And so I think you're very much onto something. And I just don't see, and I'm, you know, it sounds like you also don't see that the waiting for the university to change is not a solution. These enrollment hits they're taking, the demographic bomb that everyone's been talking about, the funding issues, the overdependence on the federal government for financial aid. None of this stuff is going to solve our problems. And so this notion of refocusing back on place, I think is so important. And it's also going to take some, you know, and I kind of want to get into this point of, you know, you've already talked about going to a place and getting this information, finding these people. And what strikes me as interesting is how, you know, some of the best teachers though may not be people who are from those places. Because one of the things I think that is an interesting dynamic here is you have people like myself who have a PhD. I currently live and have landed in a town that I was not born and raised in. And the reason I'm here in many ways is because I could not get a tenure track job. And so after doing that for 10 years, moving my family all over the place, recognizing that we had become placeless, it was time to stop and settle down here.
Yep.
And so trying to get a sense of place where you were not born and raised, but where practically it's going to be too tough to leave or too tough to go home. And I'm just wondering about how might Christian Halls be a source of hope in some ways for the many PhDs out there, especially Christian ones, who are like, you know what? I always dreamed of having this job of being a professor, of being a teacher. The university wasn't what I thought it was. And I love the place where I've landed, but I'm not getting to teach right now. And I think, is there an opportunity to draw on people like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I totally agree with that. Most of us do not live, I mean, we can't pretend like we're in some sort of, you know, 1800s agrarian society that we're all living where we were born.
Right.
Just not true. We're all displaced. We're all like this weird disembodied, you know, modern postmodern man. That's like, where am I? Who am I part of? Mm-hmm. So we're all struggling with this. And especially when it comes to like those of us who are in the intellectual life, like how do I embody this instead of what's basically devolved to just, you know, online interchange.
Yeah.
You know, where my community becomes my, you know, interlocutors online, but is this actually having any impact with anyone around me? Do I even know anybody? Have I talked to somebody in person about these ideas in the last 30 days?
Yeah.
And most of us are like, no, we haven't. We don't have friends. We don't have collegium, you know, mm-hmm. a collegium around us. And so one of the reasons that the way that we design this and with our universities, we've really built three different, and I'm going to talk about the formal educational side of this. I will say that I'm not just interested or locked into like formal degrees.
Yeah.
That is the currency of the day. And so I'll talk about these things in terms of degree programs and certifications and those kind of things. But I think it actually goes well beyond that. But just thinking about, you know, formal education with our university partners, three different instructional models that is really intended to engage with our intellectual leaders in different ways. The first one is what I would call kind of the baseline Oxfordian model, where there is a assessor at the university, you know, an examiner, a professor who is overseeing syllabus and curriculum and those kind of things. And there is a local tutor that is a subject matter competent individual, but is not necessarily standing up and giving full lectures. They're not setting the curriculum, but they know what the professor is going to require. They have the syllabus in hand, and they're there to guide the students through their readings, ask questions, create a peer review environment where students are not just, you know, in Canvas, online, banging at an essay with no engagement. They hit submit, and the professor at the other end's like, 84, I guess.
Yeah.
And like, sadly, like that's education for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of students every year in America. Yeah. And so by reinserting the human space, that the in-person human space into that community, I'm able to bring somebody in, you know, a local tutor that loves American history and always has loved American history. And these students need to take a course in history. And rather than going off to their secular community college or jumping online to, one of our large, even evangelical online universities, here is a person that is dedicated their life, loves American history. Why would you not want to sit with that person? And this idea came to me for the first time in Oxford when I had to do a little bit of Syriac for my doctoral program. And my doctoral supervisor, Marcus Bachmuehl, said, "Well, hey, go to this house and knock on this door. Here's an address, and just read with this guy." And knocked on the door. This older gentleman with wild white hair came to the door. Oh, I've heard you were coming. Wonderful. Come in. Come in, tea." Sebastian Brock is like the world's greatest scholar in Syriac literature, but he's emeritus and isn't all he wants. He spent his entire life studying Syriac and Ephraim and the Eastern Fathers, and would love nothing more than to sit with somebody and read. There's no faculty requirements. There's no, faculty meetings or those kind of things. And so that kind of human talent is sowed all the way through our communities. Nobody even knows it's there. It's not purposed. And it's really one of the greatest kind of human disasters of our cultural inheritance is the distancing of ourselves from our eldership and our intellectual heritage. So that model was the kind of the first model that we brought in to say, we've got all these online degrees, we've got all this content, we've got all these lectures. It's just digital publishing. Let's just be frank. Online education is the newest version of the printing press. It's a newer technology of how to communicate knowledge. It's digital publishing in
Well,
our university.
and artificial intelligence has almost made it, pointless, quite frankly. I mean, the level of cheating at every level has become astronomical, and just almost insurmountable in terms of trying to catch it and resist it.
At both the professor and the student
Yeah,
levels.
the professor can write their lecture with AI.
It's
They
fantastic.
can write their
Grade with AI.
tests.
And grade
Yeah.
with AI.
Yeah, it's a joke.
That's right. And everybody knows it. And so as a result, inserting an actual human back into the process may be the single most redemptive thing that we can do in the current educational space. And so once we begin to build on that model, what was interesting is that we begin to see, and I kind of describe this like a martial arts dojo, right? Great, here are these students, these white belt students meeting with at their local dojo, practicing the katas. Sometimes I only have a brown belt there to teach them. That's better than nothing. Okay, great. Better than them trying to learn, Taekwondo online. That's for sure. So here's a brown belt that's here. Are they a master? Are they a black belt? No. Are they a 13th dan, super high level black belt? No. But what's interesting is that not only are we seeing those kinds of more advanced masters and teachers emerge from our communities that are saying, wow, maybe this is a role for me in my, second career or my, retirement. But actually, it incentivizes those brown belts to continue their own education because now there's a role for them. Let's get them a master's degree. Let's get them a PhD. Let's turn them into let's give them a vision for why they would want to pursue the intellectual life when they're totally disenchanted with the tenure track option. And it's interesting that the narrative is, well, we don't need as many nobody should get their PhD anymore. There's no jobs. It's kind of a hopeless industry. And the best thing that I need, the most important critical thing that I need is more PhDs scattered across my communities. If you can invert the economy of this and say you are a valued sage, a valued member of your community, and the best thing that you could do is to contribute to generations of formation in your town, in your community, and elevate that instead of denigrate it. And so I think that it's both an opportunity to rehabilitate those of us that have gone through the educational system thinking we would go tenure track and saying, this industry sucks. I don't want to give my life to this. But is there a role for me? Yes, there is. But also, can we reimagine why the intellectual life and why human formation is so good for my community? And so I think that there's a structure there that's quite interesting. We did then, from a second instructional model, begin to see that many of our universities said, you know, if you are a professor at a classical school and you've been teaching, you know, the greats for 40 years, you know, you may not need to be the professor at the university. We won't necessarily, you know, credential you, but why don't you just instruct? You know, it's better than just than purely online. And so we've started to really kind of activate those professors or those teachers to saying, go ahead and do more than just ask questions and Socratic engagement. And then finally, we are finding that there's this whole crop of PhDs that are out there. We can rehabilitate this whole disaster that is the adjunct industry, right? Where you thought you were going to live an idyllic life, you know, at a university context, and it turns out you're going to spend the rest of your career online by yourself grading for Liberty. Which I can't imagine a more depressing end of my academic, you know, aspirations. Let's put those people back into a place. You know, can they work for the university as the professor? Absolutely. Our universities are now eager to hire those people, but let's do more than just put them online. Let's put them in a place and let them actually have their own space. And that really is kind of how the Christian Hall instructional model emerged. It's kind of a morphing from within this Oxbridge
Well, I
model.
think there's so much to be said about that connection aspect. I mean, I think I was asking, you know, we're, as the Ciceronian society grows, and I was asking because in some ways it has grown without me always knowing exactly why. And one of the things that has come up over and over and over again is, you know, these are a lot of them are university professors or graduate students, and they're so, you know, quite frankly, alone. And they don't, they've either been teaching online, right? And it's just soul crushing, or they have not been able to connect with other colleagues because first of all the colleagues' doors are closed. And they, or they come to campus, they teach, store some stuff in their office and go home. Right. There's just this incredible disconnect. You know, one of the things, reasons we're going to create the membership program that we're working on, is because, these scholars in all these different disciplines, they want to connect with each other because they can't find it on their own campuses. They're saying, well, if I want to talk to an economist one of these days and I'm an historian, I would love to be able to walk across campus and do that. But actually it turns out I can't because they're never there. And so, or they're in meetings or they're doing paperwork or assessment. And so they're looking for that. There's also this aspect of so many of us went into this career of higher ed because we love ideas, we love to read and talk about them, and when we talk about them and teach them, we learn more and we write better and we do better research and we become better scholars and we think more sharply and we connect to our tradition and to one another much more closely. And we get to the university and it turns out much of that experience has nothing to do with that dream. It's more about you know, behavioral management, classroom management, just filling out paperwork, answering emails, sitting on committees that no one actually listens to, and it becomes very, very discouraging. And so, I have seldom talked to a professor in the last 10 to 15 years that says, you know what, I just love my job. And some of them do, and they're usually teaching at a place, frankly, like Hillsdale or Grove City, I'll just name it. Most of them, but the rest of them are not. And I'm just so encouraged by what you're doing here. All right, now I want to take a step back and pick your brain on two concluding questions that might help fill in some of the gaps our listeners may be asking about. And I welcome some examples here too, because I think that will help. First, after everything you've said, how do you specifically define the concept or sense of place? And second, as these halls are becoming established and growing, What are the biggest obstacles you are facing in cultivating that sense of place, even among sympathetic tutors and students?
Yeah, that's a great question, Josh. So let's deal with the place question first. Place is complex. Place is full of people that you may not even like, but you need. Right?
Right.
And how do you turn your affections to place? And how do you serve place in what has become a very, you know, and always has been a very diverse and increasingly diverse, you know, context. And so, you know, here in Midland, Texas, where I'm based, if I come in and say, well, I'm going to build a Christian hall that is great books, text tradition, and we're only going to serve Reformed Presbyterians. That both needs to happen because we both need to serve our particular people, you know, my own kind of particular responsibilities. Although I'm not Reformed Presbyterian, but, you know, let's just say. But there is a deeper, wider need because we want our place to flourish. Like my grandkids need a place to live.
Yeah.
Need to build a place that actually is engaging with people that we may not actually, you know, naturally engage with day to day. And so one of the things that we're doing is we think about place. And when I center what we do with a Christian hall, first and foremost on place, and then people, and then programs, what are the things that this place would contribute to the flourishing of this place? And so teacher colleges, we've got to train better teachers, you know, civics programs. We need better cops. We need better public administrators. I was down in Central Texas and a sheriff walked into one of our meetings and started asking about a criminal justice program. And I just said, hold on, I don't know criminal justice. I don't know this. Yes, we have bachelor's and master's of criminal justice from multiple different universities, but how does this contribute to the life and flourishing of this town? And he said, you know, Dr. Ellis, I would immediately start a Christ Center Police Academy to train our deputies locally, kids that are coming out of high school. They want to go into law enforcement. They have to leave to go away to a police academy. You know, they don't come back. And I end up hiring people from Dallas Fort Worth, laterally hiring people. And they're not from here. They don't stay here. And more than just the professional side of this, I would like the opportunity to mentor and disciple these young police officers so they don't end up, you know, divorced and alcoholic by the time they're 45. You know, well, that's the kind of thing that we look at that we may not even be thinking, you know, as kind of academic intellectuals, you know, studying tradition and virtue. There's a real person in a real town, in a real community that contributes to the immediate flourishing of this place. There's an opportunity to invest in that person. And actually, as we pivot from place to people, this is, I believe, just as vital to that sheriff, because it gives him a role for discipleship and formation that he's never been given. And I believe that that is deeply life-giving. Because what have we done? We have effectively created a professional class of people who live cloistered elsewhere, who handle all of the education. And the people who are in their place, the wise, generational presence in our communities, we have stripped away from them the delight and joy of contributing to the next generation through their wisdom and through their knowledge. And we've said, I guess I don't have a role to play.
Yeah.
So there is, it's not just about a four-year transactional student experience. It's about how do I then move from that role to a junior fellow role in a kind of our academic language, to a senior fellow role, to a wise elder of our community. And suddenly we're starting to look at a whole flourishing environment of people and in within their place. And so then here in Midland, that means that I don't get to monopolize the space within a, you know, great books, Reformed Presbyterian context. Actually, the Anglican Church needs to be forming its people because it's a crazy situation when we have to hire a pastor from another town across the country to come in to a town of 80 people, and he doesn't know that place, he doesn't know the context, and that's the norm. Something's broken. There's just something that's broken. Something's, rotten in Denmark at that point. And so then here in a place like Midland, okay, how do we give a structure and a model for the, 67% Latino Catholic percentage of our town that currently has no bilingual Hispanic or Catholic education? I have to love them and set my affections on them just as much as on my, Reformed Protestant Anglos, because they collectively contribute to the flourishing of what this place looks like. And we're trying to build a model that allows that kind of flexibility and self-governance. Does that kind of tap into what you're asking, Josh?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it gets to a point of the extent to which education helps us get that sense of place at all. On the one hand, we'll talk about a sense of place as very specific institutions or locations. Like when I think of where I'm from in Monroe, Michigan, I might talk about a specific park or specific businesses or schools and events. And that's all part of it. But in some ways, there's always something more to a place. And the tools that education can give you can help you dig much deeper. I'm doing this right now. I'm realizing in homeschooling my son, I want to switch gears with some of the history I'm doing and teach him the history of Michigan, where I live right now. And I'm realizing how much I do not know about the state I was born and raised in, because my elders didn't tell me, but they probably didn't know either. And history is not the only aspect of a place, but it in a sense, education does give you the tools to get there. And I think that's so crucial. But I went to school in Tennessee. I went quite a ways away, and there's a connection there. At least in the Southeast Michigan context, part of the story of that place is that during the Depression and after the TVA flooded a bunch of places and kicked a bunch of people out, a bunch of people from East Tennessee moved to Southeast Michigan for jobs. And so there is a connection there. It kind of helped me come closer. But at the same time, I went away to get my education, and only recent years have come back, and still trying to figure out what does it mean to be from this place, from this state, from this community, et cetera. But and so I'm wondering then, and I think I'm kind of hinting at some of the obstacles you also might face is, you get this group of people in a room and they really want to do this, and you want to cultivate that sense of place. But I have to imagine there's some obstacles you've faced in doing this that might undermine or kind of have forced you to tweak and rethink how you're going about this. Not only in a sense of place, but like, what are some things you have found that have been moments for entrepreneurship and growth, and what questions you're still asking, I guess.
Yeah, it's, well, some of the biggest challenges that is that many of our communities have been taught to despise their place.
Right.
This can come down as simple as, like, if you don't leave Western Montana, you're a loser. If you don't leave Chester, Montana, if you don't leave Havre, Montana, you're a loser. How did you get stuck here? But we've already been inculcated in that. And it's interesting that a lot of the communities that I'm engaged with, I tend to work with a lot of classical schools, the ACCS, Association of Classical Christian Schools, SCL, Study Classical Learning. There's all these classical schools that have emerged. And it's interesting, I both drink deeply from the classical world, but I felt like there's something missing here. Some of it's kind of the intellectual tradition, and some of it's just the culture that's been embedded. And I think one of the challenges is that many of our schools, and this is certainly true in the homeschooling world as well, that we validate ourselves that I was a good classical school, I was a good homeschool parent because I got my kids into the Ivies. And if I didn't do that, if I don't have a set number of kids that went away and got into the Ivy Leagues, I don't rate myself well. And we don't have a category for we did a really good job because that student is now the mayor of my town or is now the doctor. We don't have that category. In fact, I have classical schools that literally but create bonus structures for their college, their college counselors for how many kids they send away. It's a decidedly self-destructive model for their community. It makes their school look good, but is not thinking about or targeting their space. And some of this became, as I was mulling on this, chewing on this, I pulled up C.S. Lewis wrote an essay on our English syllabus, where he is creating an apology for why they teach what they teach in Oxford when he was there. And he said, my friends are my classics, of course. I'm deeply drunk from the well of, the Latins and the Greeks and those kind of things. But then he says, living in place is education, the roots, trees, soil, food, friendship. That recentering place as a soul formational essential is just as important as kind of reading through our friends. And he says, it would be like somebody being sent away and they spend their entire life bouncing around, the grand tour, and they experience all of these delightful places, but they don't actually have a sense of who they are. And I think we Americans, we are the product of that. Like we don't even know like how to even be educated in place. And so that is my number one barrier, is culturally, I have to create a new norm that says there is something beautiful and valuable and durable that we can build in. And Americans don't do durability very well. We elect presidents every 4 years. We bounce around and we're a young country. We really have not had a 400-year experience of this in this place. This is where my great grandparents and great great grandparents are buried. So we struggle with this. And I think there is a major, almost an existential question of what does the future of the American experiment look like if we can't reroot and reground ourselves, like literally root ourselves within place. So these are all major challenges for what I'm trying to do, because how do you rebuild kind of a 950s Anglo-Saxon, Abbot-filled land with a place that is, so those are major challenges that we're trying to overcome. That being said, there is a longing that we're all beginning to feel, and we're seeing that things are broken. We're seeing that the structure, the outsourcing, the cost, the debt, the fragmented families, the inability of finding good quality spouses, like these are all things that are just now starting to happen, and we're feeling it, and we're looking around and saying there's got to be another model. And I think that this model that we've reclaimed, because we haven't, we didn't invent it, we're just reclaiming it. I think that this provides us a solution that hopefully walks hand in hand with the institutional, world. I'm not trying to burn down the institutions. I'm trying to fill in the gaps, which are increasingly large gaps.
Well, and I think there's so many thoughts come to mind here. And I think, one of the things that you're doing is you're filling out like the missing T loss, if you will. So one of the things I think classical education has done such a good job with, and then some of the entrepreneurs in Christian education as well, is they've recovered, or they are trying to recover a more human-centric, a more anthropologically rich, theologically rich understand telos of education, in the sense that we lost our sense of how education forms us to be more human, right? In one sense. And I think, getting back to these great books and getting back to these classics and many of these things, that they weren't broken. So why did progressive education reformers 100 years ago start to fix them? They were driven by, ideologies of democratism and scientism and other concepts that were just, very fundamentally utilitarian and not very superficially attached to what it means to be human. The problem is, and I think you hit the nail on the head, is that these, and I assume that when you go to these classical education schools and you talk to other professionals in this area, they immediately start to recognize it, I hope, because they're realizing that, okay, it's not just about creating or forming human persons in the fullest sense. It's about forming human persons for a particular place, because part of who we are as persons is, for lack of a better word, geographical. It is meant to be. We're not meant to be rooted and, from nowhere, in a way. And so I think what you're doing is so great. And I also was thinking, and I don't want to get into this today, but that some of what you're getting at, this kind of rootedness or lack of rootedness, rootlessness, I think there's an ecclesiological problem here too. I think, churches have perhaps in certain areas failed to appreciate their role in cultivating a sense of place. Even though I think in this world in particular, and there was a great paper delivered at the Ciceronian Society a few years ago on this, that in some ways the church is always a little out of place in a world that is secularizing. And so I think there's, it's going to be a challenge, right? I think in the sense that the church is going to be a huge part of, I think, what you're doing in cultivating these places and bringing people together. But it's also always a little bit out of place in a world that is increasingly rejecting God. But that's, I think that's a different conversation. And one more thing I want to say, I want to put this in the ear of someone maybe who's better at writing and researching on this. I think what you're describing as education for a certain place is similar to how Cicero viewed it too. I didn't think about this till just now, that in many ways, when he's advocating for duties and the development of virtue and friendship, it's not just to be a more fully human person, which he's getting there, although obviously, as Augustine would say, he's not all the way there. But Cicero never lost sight of the fact that these, you're part of a republic, you're part of a country, you're part of a place, you're part of the land, and what you're being formed for is for that place as well. So yeah, any response to that? And then I have one last question for you.
I think that's exactly right. I think Lewis would look at Cicero and say, yeah, he talked about it, but I don't know if he did it.
Right.
So like, how do we find examples?
Yeah.
Rooted, grounded examples that we can look at and say, how do we go rebuild that? Mm-hmm. And how do we bring the kind of the classical theory? And I'm going to have all your classicists call me and say, no, heresy.
Yeah.
But, you know, how do we not just talk about it? How do we actually go do it? And, you know, I think that's going to be our next great opportunity. I also think that for all of the people that are in your society mm-hmm. and that are looking at a happier future for themselves, this is just about for us, right? I mean, you feel mm-hmm. this, I feel this. Like, is it true that I have to give my lifeblood to Duke University to be a satisfied, you know, scholar?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just feels like a dystopian reality. I don't want to accept it. Yeah. And so what are the alternatives? And we've seen that the tenure track option for the intellectual life is a pretty decrepit, you know, place at this point.
Yeah.
So is there a way that we can reimagine ourselves as, you know, deeply invested, you know, place-based holders of the Christian intellectual tradition? Can we build structures that create sustainability for that? And can we create honor systems that say this is an honorable thing, not a dishonorable thing? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, such a shame that this scholar, you know, is now, you know, living in a small town and nobody knows him. Such a shame, you know, and how can we turn that narrative to what an honor? You know, this is valuable, this is beautiful, this is good. And I think that there's a narrative kind of reshaping and renorming that we can build into this country that really has not been here since the inception. So those are the kind of things that I want to do as we begin to build this stuff out.
Well, good. And so I want to give you one last, just a closing chance here then. You know, invite others to be a part of this, especially as tutors and supporters. And again, in other words, how might our listeners, you know, actually, if they're listening to this and they're really interested in what you're doing, how do they get involved? How do they learn more?
That's great. Well, I think that there's probably three levels of this. At the lowest common denominator, you know, we need people in their places to start taking students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can work with you. You could go to christianhalls.org and there's a call to action, start a hall. You know, we'd love to work with you to design what does your place need, what academic programs should we bring in, how can we train you and set you up and structure you and market you so that you can have a presence. And that is our core work, right? That's the essence of what we do. There's another level of this, which is we need to start to create our own support societies because nobody's done this before.
Yeah.
And we don't want to create isolated individual scholars sitting in their town saying, okay, I heeded the call. I went and planted the equivalent of a church. Now I'm an isolated church planner sitting out in Alaska by myself and my soul's dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we need to start to think about caring for and shaping and forming and supporting these scholars in their place. So there's a level there. I think the Ciceronian Society could be a really excellent partner in this to say, let's start to create a category for supporting these place-based, teachers and scholars.
Absolutely.
And then thirdly, we need to start to write about it. We need to start to create the kind of materials, the stuff that I'm seeing come out of, the Wendell Berry Institute or, Front Porch Republic. They're not thinking about this category. They're thinking about other things, economics and agrarian, societies and whatnot. We need to start to write about this to shape the intellectual life around this. And so, are there people that are out there that would like to start to take a bite of this? And, I think that there could be some really good doctoral dissertations on, what are the aesthetic, the ethic, the practical, the theoretical, how do we actually build this as a category for virtue formation, within place, and start to tease out some of these things that you've asked on this call, which I think are excellent. So those would be three layers. I primarily have been invested really in North America the last 3 years in building out the structures and systems for local. Mm-hmm. And so, we have about 180 of these now that are built and are operational, and we'd like to go to every county. That would be our kind of saturation goal, mm-hmm. to really shape the country. We do that really well. What I need to start to do better is that second layer. How do we start to grab other people that we would like for them to be practitioners, but we'd also like them to be trainers? I think Bruce Lee in like the 1960s, great, let's go create a bunch of karate clubs all over North America. Those don't exist. They don't have any black belts. Mm-hmm. We don't have people that know how to set up dojos. Like, how do we create a structure that encourages and advances the masters of those dojos, not just the white belts and the green belts and the brown belts? Well, we have to start to think about how do we support, advance, sustain, and guide the leadership of this movement. And I think that's where I'd like to pull in groups like yourself, classical Christian schools, other kinds of people that are, I would say, naturally gravitate to this rooted place-based idea, but they don't have a structure for advancing, the senior fellows that need to emerge from this. So those would be things that I'd love to talk about further with your audience.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. I'm sorry we don't have as much, we don't have any time left, but I really appreciate you talking to me, Nick. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Now, you've been listening to The Sower, production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. I'm not quite sure when this episode will go out. I'm guessing February 2025. But if it's not too late, join us March 13th through 15th in Harrisonburg, Virginia for our 2025 conference. I'll also mention, later in the summer, you'll see a call for papers go out for our 2026 conference. The location and time is TBD. But definitely if the research call that Nick made earlier for for place-based education and thinking through it and examples that we can look at, if that resonates with you about something to write about, please let us know. Propose a panel, propose a paper. If it's a peer-reviewed research-oriented article, let's get it in our journal Pietas. We'd love to see that. It's very much part of who we are and what we're looking at talking about. So be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. And now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.